Earl Bakken was
the he was the first, and he started a company that became Medtronic, probably called Medtronic from day one. And it grew, it was a very healthy enterprise, grew large, and spun off a lot of related activity. I did a little study for the state of Minnesota in 1987, which is quite a while ago, and at that point, there were, we traced 150 companies back to Medtronic.
Yeah, that's a typical pattern. I mean, that's the pattern in San Diego with Hybertech.
You need like a, that's a perfect example. And so you need to create, nurture, a bunch of other entrepreneurs go out and start their own businesses. And usually they do that with, or they frequently do that with capital that they've, through selling the original company, but Medtronic has gone strong for years and years and years.
And what's their capital in the region here to support?
Oh, guess what? We just turned the wrong way.
Oh, it's okay. We can get there from here.
We can?
I think.
Maybe not. But we'll try.
I've never been to Minneapolis before. I've been through the airport, and I've been to Rochester, to the Mayo Clinic, but I've never...
This is Lake Street. Which is was a big east-west artery prior to freeways. And you're out where actually our first company was. Well, I guess I want to turn right there and I'll head down. In Edina.
Oh, right. That's where you set it up.
That's where molecular genetics began, So, there was a company called Cardiac Pacemakers. There was an entrepreneur whose name was Manny Villafana, and he started St. Jude Medical, and it's a great device industry. What there hasn't been in this community is a great deal of venture capital.
Right.
And in the end, that's...
It's a limiting factor?
That's the limiting factor. So Lake Street is 30th, and we're going to 43rd and Bryant.
You have a favorite place there?
Well, we're trying a new restaurant.
Oh, okay. I'm always...
It might be 2 years old, but because I live in the country, I don't get around much.
So you can test it out for your wife.
We'll test it out. These people... We lived near here. We we lived down the road a bit, and these guys had another restaurant over here, a couple miles, and we used to eat there a great deal. And that's closed, so maybe this will do it.
And is the university nearby?
The Mississippi River is about 5 miles in the other direction, and it's basically along the Mississippi River between Minneapolis and St. Paul.
The river divides the Twin Cities.
Yeah, and the river divides Minneapolis and St. Paul.
The lights are very nice.
Oh, they're getting ready for...
Yeah, I guess so. It's seasonal, you made it. Now, is it unusual not to have snow on the ground at this time?
Well, with global warming, it's not unusual at all.
Yeah.
Last winter, we had basically a brown winter.
Really? In Minneapolis? Wow.
I don't think we ever at one time had more than 2 inches of snow.
Wow. And they say it's...
Then the winter before that, we had a very snowy winter. We had something like 90 inches of snow. Hmm. So there's no rule.
Mm-hmm.
In my head, I think that by Thanksgiving, there should be snow on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And there may be...
And in a bad year, there'll be snow on the ground at Halloween.
Yeah.
So, and it's just due to start getting cold. It's going to be like 20 in the city tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And now let's look for Bryant.
Okay. It's Lynn Lake.
Yeah. Let's see a sign there. How about this one?
This is Bryant Lake Bowl, so... Yes, this is Bryant, yes. Looks like a very livable place.
Yeah, this is called, this part of town is, this is South Minneapolis, and, you know, it varies in income all over the place, but there isn't a great deal of poverty in Twin Cities.
That's good for a city, yeah. San Francisco is pretty good, too. It's not like Chicago or Detroit, you know, where you have just these, you know, Cleveland.
The unemployment rate in Minnesota is, in the high fives, like 5.8, 5.9.
Did it escape all the unpleasantness?
Not really, but there's a lot of techie type manufacturing. There isn't Rust Belt Industries around here, and there isn't stuff like in northeastern Minnesota up near the Canadian border, there's mining.
Yeah,
the bus drivers are at the convention. Companies that are, like insurance companies, and United Health is one of the large healthcare insurance companies based here. Food companies, General Mills, Pillsbury.
Hmm.
This was originally a milling industry.
Notice that Best Buy has a big...
They're headquartered here. What's going to be with Best Buy? It's not too clear.
Yeah, no, I think they're in bad shape. But it just... I noticed it because my son, he's a teenager, he's working at Best Buy. And he's telling me, he's pretty bright.
It's going to be a new paradigm.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can shake this guy.
Yeah, you're good. I think Amazon is just killing
food them. Distribution is, I don't know if that relates to the food companies like General Mills and so on, but there's Super Value is a big owner of grocery stores, Albertsons, amongst others. They're not doing well either.
Really?
Yeah.
I think grocery stores, I mean, that's... grocery stores aren't going to go away anytime soon.
Where do you actually live?
Where do I live?
Yeah.
I live in San Francisco in the city.
What part of the city?
I live in Inner Sunset, which is right by UCSF, so doing the history of biotechnology. And
every You're in the right place.
Yeah, I look at that. Always reminded. Do you know San Francisco well?
I know it fairly well, yeah.
I
guess if I had never been there before, the biotech industry would have brought me there. But I did know it. I actually worked a summer of medical school. I worked there.
Where were you at? Were you at UCSF?
No, I was at Stanford Medical School it moved down to Palo Alto. They had a hospital in Pacific Heights, and I think that's still a hospital. It's very, very old.
Well, that's a nice place to hang out.
And I rented a room at a guest house in Pacific Heights.
Oh, that's great.
Had a wonderful summer.
Yeah.
I always thought I'd live the rest of my life there. But it didn't quite work out that way.
Well, the summers are odd in San Francisco.
I carried an umbrella.
Yeah.
for 2 weeks before, because I walked to work, before it dawned on me it wasn't ever going to rain.
That's right. Yeah, no, it doesn't rain. but the summers...
But they're kind of cold.
Yeah, the coldest month of the year in San Francisco is August.
We have friends that live there. Out closer to the ocean than you, and they have built a second home on her father's farm here in Wisconsin, right near us. Now, this is probably the restaurant.
Right here? Yeah. Piccolo?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, it looks nice.
Can we park right
here? I'm not sure.
Why not?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's okay. Yeah, it's a nice little place. Okay, good, thanks. Okay, bye-bye.
Might be noisy.
No, it's fine. Something more stupid than normal.
This recorder is... It's a great recorder. If I can hear you, it's just like ears.
My ears aren't so good. I just went to hearing aids this year.
Well, this is... It does record.
She's the same. She's the same. or else I'd be like sleepy.
Now they're supposed to have an interesting menu.
Mm-hmm.
Does that look to be so?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Brioche and foie gras gâteau with cape gooseberries.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be bad. Scrambled eggs and pickled pig's feet. Suckling pig.
Yeah, no, it's...
Oh, somebody told me that that's good.
Smoked beef tongue. So these are the appetizers, and these are
And then when you, when you get down to the third group, it seems like you're in main dishes.
Right.
Main dishes.
Right.
Sunday night, you should learn how to eat light here. Might have to skip the suckling pig.
Sablefish collar with razor and vanilla clam. Cream of cardoons. What is cardoon? Cardoon soup.
Everybody gets
emblematic. I have no idea.
It's like artichoke.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like the outside of it's like a big, gigantic, bright thistle, and the inside tastes like artichoke. Soup is unforgettable.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
Sorry, I hear everything. I'm a bartender.
That's fine.
That's okay. We appreciate that. We might do the soup.
Yes. Okay. I think I might try the soup and then...
Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi.
How are you this evening?
Very good.
We're great.
Can we bring something beyond water for you to drink right away?
I'm going to have a glass of wine, but let's see what Mark wants.
I'll join you. I'll have a glass of red wine.
I think I've turned to the reds.
I'll have a glass of the cab.
Glass of Cabernet. For you, sir?
Same thing.
The same. Right away, gentlemen. Welcome again.
Oh, that's too funny. I never had a nemesis, but I didn't
It's really small, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was like, two of my, like, we had like a buddy
system too.
He was with my father, so I was switching.
Well, shall we begin?
Sure. How would you like to begin?
Why don't we start with the biographical background?
I'm a physician. I'm from Minnesota. I was born in Duluth, Minnesota.
Duluth, okay.
But came down here in junior high school and graduated high school in Minneapolis. Went to the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota Medical School.
Let me ask you about growing up and your family.
Oh, my father was a lawyer in Duluth. He died young, and when he died, that's what actually brought us down to the Twin Cities.
So you were a teenager at that time?
Yeah, I was 12 when he died. So we came down here when I was 13, and I was in like the 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
So
that have a big impact on you at that time?
Is that why I became a doctor?
Well, no, I have no idea.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I always, you know, from those teen years on, I knew I was going to be a physician.
You did?
Yeah. When I graduated medical school, I mean, high school, I went to work in one of the city hospitals here as an orderly. And I was a pre-med in college, and then went to medical school. I didn't know that I would necessarily wind up being a dermatologist, but I did. When I graduated medical school in 1961, I'm 76 now, I went to L.A. County Hospital on a rotating internship, married, and just before I started my internship. And when I finished the internship, I went up to the University of Oregon to do my residency in dermatology. So,
why did you select dermatology?
I don't know. I like to look at things. I was I drew a lot. I was kind of a half-assed artist as a youth, and that sort of fit my sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I later went on to organize and run a training program in dermatology, so I heard why other people went into dermatology. I was at Albert Einstein in the Bronx, which is part of Yeshiva University, and the Orthodox Jewish kids didn't want to work on the Sabbath, and they thought that if they were dermatologists, they would be excused.
Right.
I thought about that too. I was like, okay.
Yeah. That didn't sit well with me, and I didn't hire any of them.
Uh-huh.
I went to a program. I thought I would go. By that time, I thought I still wanted to live in San Francisco. And I thought I would go to Stanford for my dermatology residency. And before I left here as a graduate medical school, I went to the head of dermatology here. His son was a classmate of mine in medical school, so I knew him.
Gentlemen, do I have some questions on our menu?
Well, we got a recommendation for this cream of cardoon soup. Is that a good choice?
I don't think there's really any bad way to go, but people certainly have their preferences. Well, don't interrupt conversation. Sip some wine and settle in, and I'll stop back shortly.
Okay. I might do the soup and the duck.
Yeah, I think I'm going to try the sable fish collar.
I gave that some thought, but I don't think... Manila crabs are those great big ones, aren't they? I don't think
they're
like
clams.
Those.
Yeah.
Oh, Manila clams.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think I like those, but then I might.
Pumpkin agnolotti.
I have no idea.
I'm sure it's all good.
I don't know any of those things.
But the thing she says...
Pistachio dessert have been the highlights, the bookends of the meal.
Okay. Pistachio cake.
Pistachio cake was phenomenal. The bookends.
That coffee looks pretty good, though.
It's underwhelming.
Nice, but
underwhelming? Okay.
So, when I went to meet with the chairman of the Derm Department here in Minnesota, he said, I'll get your residency at Stanford if you'll go up to what's now Oregon Health Sciences and interview up there. There's a new man that just took over. He's just starting a program. And I think you'll be impressed.
And you are envisioning a career in
clinical
research? No,
at that time, clinical dermatology.
Right. So
I said, sure, I want to go to Stanford, but I'll go meet the other guy. And I stopped at Stanford first, and the first thing that guy asked me was, what's your draft status?
So 1960.
It was 62. In 62, there was a draft.
Yeah. Okay.
So I said, "Well, I've applied for a deferment for my residency training. That was called the Berry Plan. And if I get that, I'll go in the Army after I finish my clinical training." And he said, "Well, that sounds pretty iffy." So I went up to see this guy in Portland, and he said, "I'd like you to come here as a resident. Francis tells me that I should take you, and Francis is never wrong." And I said, "Yes, but Dr. Lovitz, I don't know what my military status is. I might not ever get here, or I might get here and I get drafted." And thank you. So he put his arm around me and he said, "Look, if you get drafted, you get drafted. When you get out of the Army, I'll still be here, and you'll come and join me. I don't care about that."
So that was more inviting.
Considerably. So that was, in fact, my first entrepreneurial experience, because it was a new program. By my third year, I was the senior resident and worked with the chief closely and started to do a little research in the lab there.
Was that part of it appealing to you at the time, the fact that it wasn't?
I didn't realize it, only in retrospect. Now I get out of the service. I did get the Berry Plan deferment. Now I got to go in the Army as a dermatologist.
Afterwards.
And I finagled a research job at Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland, Chemical Warfare Research Center.
Oh, okay. That explains your...
I thought I was headed there, but and I got there. I did my basic training, and I went to just north of Baltimore. It was the middle of summer, and I developed a taste for blue crabs, sea crabs. But probably around late October, I got a telegram telling me that I was being reassigned to the Far East. And I would report to Fitzsimmons in Denver the 1st of December. Yeah, it was a shock. I called the guy.
When they said Far East, does that mean Vietnam? Southeast Asia?
I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they said, we're ready.
How are you doing, John?
Good.
What can I bring?
I'm going to do soup and duck.
I'll have the soup and the sago fish collar.
Well, welcome again, John.
Thank you.
Not bad. It turned out that the war had heated up in October of 65.
I'd like to visit there someday, all right?
They found themselves short of doctors and medical facilities. So what happened is 34 physicians and 400 nurses and corpsmen gathered in Denver for a week of training, and then got in four airplanes, including Tokyo. I had a feeling that I was going to Japan because I'd been told to take a winter uniforms along. There is military hospitals in Okinawa and the Philippines and so on, but they wear summer uniforms all year. I was my clue. And
first clue.
Korea, I could have been going to Korea, but that seemed too far off.
Or the Aleutian Islands, maybe.
That seemed too far off the beaten track.
Yeah.
So We built great commanding officer is a surgeon. We built a 1,000-bed general hospital very quickly. And that was my second entrepreneurial experience.
So you were involved in directing, telling them how to design them?
No, I was just a doctor.
Yeah.
But it was an invigorating experience.
Mm-hmm.
I brought my wife and baby over, had a second baby in Japan, did some work at the Air Force Hospital as well as my own hospital, went back to the United States to take my board exams in dermatology, and I thought while I was there, I had pretty much in my mind by that time decided that I wanted to do something in academic medicine when I got out of the Army.
And why? What led you to that conclusion?
Thanks.
I had done a little research as a resident. I had published a paper. I had presented at National Dermatology Society. And I was getting the bug. I talked to one of my teachers who knew the Department of Medicine chairman at Albert Einstein, and Einstein didn't have a full-time dermatologist, didn't have a dermatologist. And dermatology was part of the Department of Medicine. So I went there to interview, and I interviewed at maybe three or four places across the United States. I thought about my wife at the time was from L.A., and I thought about going to Los Angeles.
Did she want to go there?
Yeah, she would have been happy going on. But she had worked in New York. When we first met, she was working in New York. So that was good.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me, this man by the name of Irving London, who was one of the superstars of American medicine in the 60s, 70s.
What was his field?
Hematology. He was a research hematologist at Lamb. He said that he named a man, Aaron Lerner, who was the head of dermatology at Yale. And he said, I can't get Aaron to come down here. It was basically a Jewish school, and Aaron was Jewish. And most of the people who gathered in 1954 to begin it were academics of that faith.
Yeah, there was some breakfast.
So he said, you're no Aaron Lerner. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you get you a fellowship, a postdoctoral fellowship, and you'll go into the lab, and you'll work in the lab for 2 years. And if we like each other at the end of that time, you'll be my dermatologist. And I went into an immunochemistry laboratory with a physician scientist whose name was Don Marcus, and it was very basic immunochemistry. And I had a couple of ideas that were extensions of the work I had done as a resident.
Tell me about that.
Well, it had to do with the mechanisms of eczema, the allergic rash that people get. And I thought we could shed some light on that. And I did a year's worth of work. And and it resulted in a good paper, and I applied for an NIH grant based on that work, and I didn't get the grant. And my mentor said to me, you know what? You better start thinking about cancer.
Easier to, this is the war on cancer era, right?
Right.
Yeah.
He said,
maybe a little bit before it, but.
He said, I'm going to take my work and I'm going to reorient it towards issues that allow me to get cancer funding. And you better.
Wait, is this 1971? Are we that?
No, it's 19. 68,
yeah.
Early 69.
Yeah, but it's already.
It's going in that direction. But he was pretty prophetic.
Sure. No, that's good advice, right?
We were in the Ullman building. That's a totally laboratory building, and that's where the molecular biologists were at the time.
Yeah.
And
so this work you had done, this work as a resident.
I had started thinking about eczema as a resident,
and you continued that
for the chemistry of that for a year.
What did you find out?
Well, I scoped out a simple project. I thought that people are allergic to formaldehyde. You might be aware of that. There used to be a lot of formaldehyde in clothing. In fact, the wife and I bought some bed sheets yesterday, and I was commenting that they no longer smell like formaldehyde. People are allergic to formaldehyde. But formaldehyde is a very, very small molecule. How can you be allergic to that? So what I thought happened is that what formaldehyde did is it changed the shape of a protein in your body, in your skin, for instance, and that's what you were actually allergic to, not formaldehyde per se.
Right.
And I proved that to be true using serum albumin in rabbits.
Had anybody ever identified that mechanism before?
No, nobody gave a shit.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And nobody kind of got it.
Yeah. Have they gotten it since?
No.
No?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
So he said, what do you want to do with cancer skin? And I said, well, here's something interesting. People get warts, usually as teenagers or children. And those are tumors of the skin that disappear spontaneously. I think we should, they're caused by a virus. I think that we should take a look at that. I'm going to take a look at that.
This is the era where oncogenes are being discovered, right?
Right. Now, but I was in an immunochemistry laboratory, and we thought that the mechanism for the disappearance of those warts was an immunological mechanism, which in fact it is. Although I'm not sure that's fully understood yet either. So, I did some very rudimentary experiments. That was the year that a man by the name of Jake Maisel had returned to Einstein from a sabbatical in Cambridge, England, where he had worked in Krug's electron microscopy laboratory and had the first electron micrographs of wart virus. So we collaborated. We did some morphologic work, we did some immunologic work, and I applied again for an NIH grant, and lo and behold, I got it.
You said the magic words.
About that time, in 72, my wife and I separated.
Those are terribly, terribly hot bowls. And then it's still cheese, potato gnocchetti, and caramelized onion puree. I'll be right back with the soup itself.
Okay, great.
He's going to pour it over this?
I'm not sure. Oh, okay. It's hot.
Because those are no cheese. And I don't know what that is.
that's on your shirt.
Oh, yeah.
It's rich.
You should have asked if it had a cream
base. Yeah, I love board games. Oh, my goodness. We have a, few.
Enjoy.
That
thank you.
That I'm really bad at.
So we wrote a couple papers then on sort of the basic morphology and antigenicity of the wart virus. Mm-hmm. When I separated from my wife.
At around that time?
Yeah, in 72.
So everybody is their own player.
Began living with another woman. And my wife and two young children moved to LA. And I was feeling a little lonely and isolated. We were talking about getting married and thought that living in Manhattan and scrambling to make a living was counterproductive.
Living as a physician, scrambling.
Well, yeah, but I was spending most of my time in the lab.
Yeah.
I had a residency. I started a residency training program. I brought in a
started administering. In dermatology.
Yeah.
At Albert Einstein.
Yeah. I started that training program. I have brought in when Irving told me that I could have the dermatology job, I said I need residents. Start a training program. I said, I will, but I need a clinical dermatologist as a partner in that because I don't want to do clinical dermatology anywhere near.
Did he say, I know a guy at Yale?
No, I found a resident coming out of Harvard, and he joined me.
And Emma was determined that we could.
And he just retired 2 years ago as chief of the program there, which he had headed for years.
Ooh. And there are ways you can get sent back to your age.
So it became a real institution.
And it did.
We all made it. Me,
so
my other sister.
I thought about coming back here. My wife could be come here to meet my mother in the summer of 72.
She starts bawling.
There was a new chief in dermatology at the university, and I wound up moving here July of 1973. I just moved my research grant, my equipment, everything.
And did you say you had gotten married?
I wasn't married when I moved here. I was married
after.
In August of 73.
The
second time.
Where was your wife from? Your second wife? She was
from Lorain, Ohio. She was my laboratory technician in New York.
So Minnesota is not that, Ohio's not that far from Minnesota.
She considered herself a Midwesterner.
I didn't like playing that because
that's a stretch.
The first time I played it, but
Ohio?
I guess not. When you look at this election,
and I felt really bad.
You sort of think Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin in one breath. Well, you didn't back then.
No?
I didn't. Not if you're from Minnesota.
I guess. You're thinking
Nebraska,
Iowa.
There were no Norwegians in Ohio.
Right.
So we came back here. By that time, the wart work was looking interesting. There was, Einstein had a cancer center grant, the first wave of cancer center grants. At least the research part of that, maybe there was only a research part of that, was run by a man whose name was Harry Eagle, of Eagle's Medium, which is...
culture medium.
It was
a family business, or it was him?
He's just the developer of it. He was an academician who probably come out of the NIH, I'm not sure where. There's generational difference. I was maybe in my late 30s, and he was in his early 60s or something. But that was an interesting group, a very basic researcher. So when the study section people came around to do site visits, they would trot me out because I was the only person doing anything that had clinical relevance. I was the only physician in the group.
I don't know how to blow people, but I totally learned.
So,
had you made any connection to cancer at that point?
No, I have not. So, they gave me money for a postdoc.
How right you are.
After he was with me for a year, I moved to Minneapolis. He came with me for a second postdoc. He was Japanese. He was a Japanese physician. He spent 2 years in my lab. By the time I got here, I was somehow or other recognized in the small circle of in the world of people interested in war fibers. And after I had been here about a year, I brought in a Frenchman who was my equivalent in French. I had the first, at that time, only NIH grant for wart virus, which is quite unusual because now there are thousands of.
Sure.
So his name is Gerard Orr. He thought that it was an oncogenic virus.
Had you thought that before? Is it?
Not really.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I brought him here to give a lecture. And in the back row of this little amphitheater, very steep amphitheater, there was a heckler in the back row asking all sorts of scientific questions that Orth, who had trained with Monod at the Pasteur Institute, but was at a different institute, Gustave Roussy, he couldn't answer those questions. And I thought that this guy in the back row was kind of rude. It was very rude.
But they were good questions.
Yeah. After Orth left, some guy called me up, and I figured out that he was the guy in the back row. And he said, I'm a retrovirus virologist, molecular biologist, but I want to get into DNA viruses. We're going to work together. I said,
he's also presumptuous, right? Rude and
right.
Yeah. Okay.
His name was Tony Ferris, Anthony Ferris. And I said, you gotta be nuts. He said, no, come on over to my lab. And with it, by the end of that year, whatever year it was, 74 probably, maybe 75, I had moved all my equipment out of my lab into his lab, and we had a joint papillomavirus group put together. He assigned two of his postdocs to working on papillomavirus.
What had he been doing in his lab prior to that?
Retrovirus.
Oh, right, yeah.
He had postdoc with Michael Bishop.
Okay. Yeah.
Now we have basically one lab. I went off campus to see patients in the afternoon. By that time, I was pretty hungry. Had alimony to pay and stuff like that. And so I went to university in the morning and over to a suburban practice very close to your hotel in the afternoon. And that was my life for a few years. Now, very early on, after Gerard had left town, I saw a woman in clinic that had both warts and cancer on her perineum, between her vagina and her anus. And it dawned on me that Orth was probably right.
Mm-hmm.
So we started studying that woman. That was at the moment they were beginning to type papillomaviruses. We realized that all papillomaviruses weren't born equal.
How many are there?
Now? I have no idea.
They're multiplied.
Back in those days, there were maybe a dozen.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, we found her type of papillomavirus in her cancer. And
was that the first connection that was made?
Yes.
Everything is perfect.
And that was a big deal, right?
Pardon?
And that was, people recognized that as a big deal.
No.
No. they have since.
By that time, there was a third academician involved. His name was Harold Zurhausen.
At Minnesota?
No, Germany.
Oh, okay.
Maybe Heidelberg at that point. Harold, 2 years ago, got the Nobel Prize for that discovery. When we met Harold, he thought that cervical cancer was caused by herpes virus.
Yeah, most of the guys are related.
There could be a connection there, is there not?
Nah.
It's
caused by papillomavirus.
Could there be other viral?
There could. I don't think there is. But I don't know. I haven't kept up with the field at all in years. This is a long time ago.
But that's interesting. So how did?
Well, I made a mistake. I'm a lot wiser at this age than I was in my early 40s. And I went to a meeting. I had a paper in press or submitted, which I thought would be published, and two subjects that were really breakthroughs in the wart scene. And I presented them at a dermatologic scientific meeting in Kyoto in 1982. And Harold wasn't there. Harold's a perfectly nice man, but he wasn't there. But one of his disciples was there, a man from his lab, and they got up in a discussion and said that what I said wasn't correct. They had looked at they had looked at 25 cancers in the vagina, cervix, perineum, anus, and hadn't found wart virus in any one of them. Well, they were using the wrong probe, wrong viral type, and they missed it.
We don't have any data.
But not for long. In fact, and then I presented a paper that had to do with the immunology of wart viruses, and those, and one group went home and repeated my work and published it like a week later, and maybe 3 months later, before my paper was published. And then Zierhausen's first published before we published.
That's a little, that's an interesting little episode in the history of science.
It is. It has to do probably more to do with the politics of science. If we skip forward 30 years, you would realize all of a sudden I got up one day and I was, somebody sent me an article from the Philadelphia Inquirer about Harold Zierhausen discovery. And I turned to my wife and I said, I bet you Buck he's hired a PR firm. And he most certainly had. I called Gerard Orth when Harold won the Nobel Prize, and I asked him how he felt about it, because it was really his original idea. Maybe our observations, but his idea. I like to see the guy with the idea honored. He's retired, and he was unfazed. He didn't care one way or the other.
Yeah.
Tony Ferris and I, and some of the young men that we were working with at the time, probably the young men more than us, have been uncomfortable because of that. Anyhow, now it's 1978. And we get a call to Tony's lab from a veterinarian on campus in the vet school, saying that there's a herd of dairy cattle in southern Minnesota, actually about 60 miles south of Minneapolis, that are the calves are severely infected with warts. So
was that unusual for?
I mean, we knew there was a bovine papillomavirus, but we weren't paying any attention to it. And we knew that that rabbits have a papillomavirus, Shope papillomavirus. And Shope had discovered that while a faculty member at the University of Minnesota. And Shope's lab technician was still around, and I used him to trap rabbits for me on the Mississippi riverfront of the medical school. And we, in fact, did some experiments on those rabbits with the Shope virus, but we weren't looking at the bovine virus at all. And we drove down. I recall the day I was driving a Jeep, like a Jeep Wrangler, a real Jeep, before there was a Wrangler. And Tony and I and my very young son drove down there. And we saw these calves. There were like 14 of them. One of them had 14 pounds of warts on them. So
did you excise them and weigh them? Is that how you know 14 pounds?
They actually took that calf to the slaughterhouse. So we had, for months, we had fantasies about work burgers at McDonald's. Why would they waste those works? No, we heard that secondhand.
Yeah.
So,
but maybe hot dogs.
But driving home from the farm that day, it was the Anderson farm. I said, I think we should make a vaccine for calves, vaccinate them against wart. And Tony said, I know how to do that. We'll use recombinant DNA technology. We'll make what's effectively a subunit vaccine by cloning the protein on the surface of the virus. And then I said, you know, I've been doing some consulting in the pharmaceutical industry.
You had been.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I'll come back to that in just a minute. I think we should start a company to do that. We shouldn't do that at the university. It's separate from our cancer research. There's no conflict of interest. And we could do it as principals in a company. And he said, you know, I know a guy at UCSF. I think he has started a company. What's his name? His name is Herb Boyer.
Yeah, what's the year here? This is
78.
78. So
they started in 76.
Yeah, and they're still very small.
They were.
Until they clone insulin, then everybody knows about them.
Right. He said, how do we start a company? I said, I don't know. But on Saturday mornings, I fish with Norman. And Norman knows all about starting companies. He's a consultant. And we'll talk to Norman. And Norman said, you have to write a business plan.
And Norman who?
Norman Sidley.
Sidley.
And so I said, okay.
Tony's a fisherman too.
He is. And Tony and I fished together, but he didn't fish on Saturday mornings with Norman and me. So I got the three of us in a room together, and we decided we would start a company. And Norman convinced us that he would get a third of it, and each of us would get a third of it.
Had you thought previously about starting a company?
Yes.
What sent your thoughts down that path? Besides the need to make more money.
Summer of 1970, well, probably in 71, I got a call. At Einstein, you took August off. You know, if you were a psychiatrist, all your patients committed suicide. But I was a dermatologist. I wasn't missed. And I would take my family back to 71. I was still living with my first wife, and we went back to L.A. And I got to L.A., and the next day I got a call from Abe White. Are you familiar? There were the standard biochemistry textbook in medical schools at that time was White, Handler, and Smith. Abe was the chairman of the Department of Biochemistry in Einstein. He and I got friendly because...
All right. So I'll start with the silverfish collar.
Oh, that's here.
Just kidding. That worked out. With mill clams, razor clams, and some pickled butt mushrooms. Here is the Nora duck breast on top of violet mustard with black grapes and a little foie gras.
Thank you.
Would you like to try some of this?
Look, good. You can't eat that much, can you? You probably have to share that with me.
Yes, I think I will.
And this looks a lot like sausage to me.
It's the duck, right? You got duck?
Yeah. It was Abe White on the phone to me. He had a... when I got to Einstein, he had a postdoc in his lab whose name was Alan Goldstein. Went on to be chairman of biochemistry at George Washington University. I don't know if he's retired yet or not, but he was there for a number of years. That's faux gras, so that's nice. This might be caviar. Guess it is. One day a week, Alan and I would have lunch in Abe's office with Abe. That big office. Yeah, tiny little office. We were postdocs. But that continued on when we were faculty members. And so Abe called and he said, I want to give your name to a friend of mine who can use you as a consultant. And if you don't mind, I'll have him call you. And his name was Irv Solons. It's a very interesting name. So Irv's on the phone the next day and he tells me what his needs are, and I said, great, my power alley. I'll be back in town August 30th and we'll get together. No, he said, you'll be in my office tomorrow morning. I said, you gotta be kidding. No, he said. Buy yourself a first class ticket and be in my office at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Have a great night to you. So I did. And I worked with her as a consultant for a few years. Irv was a pharmaceutical entrepreneur.
At a time when pharmaceutical entrepreneurs are rare,
right.
hard industry to break into.
Right. I'll tell you how he did it. And he had just been brought out of retirement by his friend who was chairman of Novo, the enzyme company in Copenhagen. They had just brought enzymes into laundry detergents in the U.S., and there was a controversy about their safety. Both from a systemic immunologic standpoint and cutaneous. I'm an immunochemist, dermatologist, natural.
Right.
And by the way, before I came to New York, he said, and if I like you tomorrow night you'll be on a plane to Copenhagen. And that next day I had lunch with the chairman in his private dining room. I thought that was
chairman
cool.
Chairman of Novo?
Uh-huh.
In Copenhagen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I led the Soap and Detergent Association put together a study group to kind of solve the problem, and I was I participated in the planning of what needed to be done and so forth.
What was the problem? It was there.
It was a protein.
And it was allergenic.
It was allergenic. It didn't cause problems in consumers, but it did cause problems in factory workers.
Did you?
We proved it.
You had to do research to establish the problem.
That project probably went on for about 3 years. We either won the battle or the war, and we lost the other one, because in the interim, Procter & Gamble took the enzymes out of Tide, which was this company's source of revenue. But I stayed on as a consultant to Novo for a year or two, even after I moved to Minneapolis. Irv Solondz was a boy from Baltimore who got a PhD in public health, maybe at Johns Hopkins. Got drafted WW2 into the Public Health Service and went as a public health officer to the city of Chicago, which was full of sailors with venereal disease, and he cleaned it up.
How did he do that?
I have no idea. I have no recollection now. We'd have to do a little research. But you should think about Irv and the history, sort of what leads to the history of biotechnology. Irv at the end of the war, he was invited by the government to head an organization called, maybe it was called UNRWA, UNRA or UNRHA, but his job was to go around the world and beg for drugs to put in Western Europe at the end of the war, 1945. And during the course, which he did successfully, but during the course of the of his travels, he went to Mexico City to get, I think what he was after was topical steroids from the
Syntex?
Company that became Syntex.
No kidding.
There were two brothers. And you'd have to do a little research. And they fell in love with Irv. And they invited him to join Syntex when he finished this project. And he did. And Irv is somehow or other responsible for the birth control industry in the United States.
He was involved in synthesizing, what was it, orethindrone?
In managing that process. So Gregory Pincus, people like that, were his buddies.
They were involved with Searle, Rosencrantz and Gerassi and Zaffaroni. Those were the guys at Syntex who synthesized.
They worked for Irv.
Yeah. Uh-huh, okay.
He hired Abe White out of Yale. And Abe went full-time with Syntex. And I don't know how they got moved from Mexico City to Palo Alto.
Yeah,
but they did.
Yeah. That was 1962, 64, and they moved up. Yeah.
I don't know when Abe went to Einstein. But he went from Yale to Syntex to Einstein. And that was the connection with Irv Solondz. So, now, I can't accurately tell you the details because Irv was a private guy, but he was kind of like a father figure to me. I was in my 30s, and
he offered you this exciting opportunity, right?
To consult.
Yeah.
And then what he did is he got colon cancer. And the cancer was about the size of my little fingernail. Very small. And it scared him badly. And he, I went to see him in the hospital, I remember. Dean and I went to see him. After he got out of the hospital, a few months later, he gave me a call. And he said, I want you to meet me for lunch at a favorite restaurant in Mamaroneck. Mm-hmm. And I met him, and he said, here's what's going on. Tomorrow, the patents on birth control pills expire. And I want to start the next day, day after tomorrow, I want to start a generic birth control pill. And we're going to make them for a nickel, and we're going to sell them in Africa for $1 a month or whatever, a year, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I can't do it myself. So I want you to leave Einstein and join me, and you're going to be the feet on the ground in this enterprise. Will you do it? And I gave it about 10 seconds of good thought, and he said, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll call you in a week. He called me in a week, and he said, I can't do it. I'm too frightened about the cancer and everything. I'm not going to work anymore. I'm going to stay retired. He had retired from Novo.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't do that, but it, you know, it set off a few wheels in my head. I had also been doing some consulting in the dermatology area for Shearing Plow and for Dermic, and which were in Philadelphia. So I had kind of a feel, whatever you can have as a consultant, mm-hmm. of what those businesses might be like.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been talking to Tony Ferris about.
Although, those are big businesses.
Solens, retired from Syntex, and he sold his equity in Syntex for something like $5 million. He may have owned 25% of the company, if you can imagine. And he bought a farm in Puerto Rico and started growing Mexican yams.
That's and, what that and where he, they derived.
And he started the birth control businesses for Cyril and J&J. Each time he would retire, and then he'd get sucked back into the business.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So he was a real pharmaceutical entrepreneur. The steroid nucleus had been discovered as a plant extract by a guy by the name of Marker, who is a biochemist at Harvard. And he's an interesting part of that story.
Yeah.
He had rented a hotel room.
Pardon me, gentlemen. Can I bring menus back? Or,
I know what I would like. You want some dessert? Yes.
No.
No?
I'm just going to have espresso coffee if I could.
Espresso.
I'll have the chicory coffee.
The panna cotta.
Yeah, yeah.
And he purified some compound from the forests of Mexico in a hotel room in Mexico City and brought it into the brothers at Syntex, kind of dumped it in their lab.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the birth of that industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the connection to yams and so forth. But
so that's it. Was the extract from the yams that was and Mark.
So Irv had been involved in all of that. Mm-hmm. We wrote a business plan in '78. We
had you been aware of
nothing.
Nothing.
I lived in the Outback.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Yeah.
We knew that Herb Boyer had a business.
Yeah.
Tony, why don't you give Boyer a call? We'll learn something. Academicians shouldn't be screwing around with companies.
So he was resisting the idea?
Yeah, he wouldn't call Herb Boyer.
Uh-huh.
So we wrote a business plan. By that time, Abe had retired and from Einstein, and he had gone to Syntex in Palo Alto. And when we had a business plan, let's say in the fall of 1978, and I'll tell you what the plan was in a minute. But this is a cute story. Took it to Abe said, "I'll introduce you to a venture capitalist that we have in residence at Syntex, and you can come out here and meet the guy," which I did. And the guy said, "That's a cute business plan. I don't think we're interested in that."
What was his name?
I don't recall. A venture capitalist at Syntex? I don't recall.
It wasn't Zaffaroni, was it?
Oh, no. By that time, Zaffaroni had...
He was gone?
He was
gone. Yeah. Oh, this is the 70s. Yeah. Okay. Long gone.
This is 78.
Yeah, he's gone 10 years, yeah.
I never met Zaffaroni. I never met Carl Gerasi either. But I knew those guys through Abe, because I remained close to Abe until he died. He looked at, we had fussed around with what we were going to call this thing, and we called it Biogene.
Uh-huh.
And we took it to Syntex, and the guy said, "Nice business plan, but I think there's a company, I think I saw a business plan of a company in Boston called Biogen."
Like yeah.
Oh shit, we better change the name.
Yeah.
So we spent all night one night drinking and trying to think of what our next name was, and we couldn't think of a name, so we just called it Molecular Genetics, Inc. Now, the interesting thing is, after we got funded a year later, in 79, we heard that there was a company that had started in Los Angeles called Applied Molecular Genetics.
Yeah.
So I got my lawyer, I didn't know George Rathman, I got my lawyer to write George a letter, and he wrote back, all apologetic. They had a meeting, and they renamed the company Amgen, which was a much better name than either Molecular Genetics or Applied Genetics.
Yeah, as it turns out, yeah.
Genetics. So, for years when George would come to speak in Minneapolis, he would credit me with the name.
Great, thanks.
So we wrote a business plan to make a vaccine to bovine borderers for cows. That's all we were going to do.
And that's what the plan said. This is before you have funding. This is just the idea. Yeah.
Yeah, but we wrote that up, let's say, by the 1st of October of 1978. We didn't raise money until November 19th, 1979. So it took us maybe 13, 14 months to raise like $1.2 million.
Where did you go? What kind of attempts did you make?
We just really, we put Norman in charge of raising the money.
And he's a friend of yours. What was his background?
Norman was a consultant to Honeywell for years. Don't ask, we never knew what Norman did.
Uh-huh.
But he was savvy.
And he was a business guy.
Very bright guy. He's my age. I knew him from college. He married a very good friend of mine. We talked to venture capitalists.
From where? East Coast? West Coast?
Uh-huh. Probably not much in the West Coast, but maybe a couple. We in a few small venture capital firms around the Twin Cities. Go ahead and eat.
Okay.
I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I'll get my coffee. Maybe you'll have coffee later. So, now we finally attract investors. Let's say it's the spring of 1979, and April, May. We've got some investors lined up, and the lead is going to be a venture capital firm that's part of what's now Wells Fargo. It's Norwest Bank. It was called the Growth Fund. And there were two young men in the Growth Fund that had come from Harvard Business School in 77 or 78. And we met them probably in early 79. And we lined up four investors.
They were the first?
They were one. They became the lead and responsible for the due diligence. The other investors were Sprout, Donaldson Lufkin and Genrep, First Chicago, which was still a bank back then, and a angel investor in the Twin Cities.
And what was his or her interest in?
They were just philanthropic, and they thought that this could lead to something that would benefit college.
Mm-hmm.
The whole process of their due diligence was pretty interesting, especially Sprout.
Mm-hmm.
Sprout sent in one of the co-founders of Data General, one of the Boston firms, mm-hmm. who told us that you couldn't put, you couldn't put mammalian genes into bacteria. That would never work.
There was some question before it was done. What was the year here? No.
Oh, it had been done.
Yeah,
it was 78, 79.
Yeah.
Now we've got a draft of an agreement with the investors, shareholders, stock purchase agreements, and by accident, there's a dedication of a new building on the Duluth campus of the medical school, and the guest speakers are going to be Toni Ferris, who graduated from there, and Herb Boyer. And they go out for drinks, and now, at the 11th hour, he tells Herb what we're up to.
Mm-hmm.
And Herb said, don't sign anything. The two of you get in an airplane. I'll talk to Bob Swanson. And you sit with Bob. and spend the day at Genentech. And so we did. Bob picked us up at our hotel in San Francisco, and we went down to Palo Alto. Thank you. And the other guy attending that meeting was Eugene Kleiner. And they had read our business plan, and they had read the offer. And Kleiner said, no, you could do better than this. You know, why don't you go back to these guys and tell them you want 1, 2, 3. And I said, you've got to be nuts. It's taken us forever to find these guys. Now it's like maybe it's August, September, October. We're going to close. And he said, you tell them that if they don't give you the money with those terms, that I will.
Eugene Kleiner is one of the, he's one of the pioneers of Silicon Valley.
The only day I ever saw him, but we spent the whole day together. And we went back to our guys and made him this counter offer, and the next day they accepted it.
It was a worthwhile journey then to go to Genentech.
But there was a wrinkle. Later in the day, we looked around the Genentech building. There were 16 employees. Bob Swanson said, you know, we don't do any immunological stuff at all.
Yeah.
Or anything that's like what you guys do.
You know,
virology.
Well, Genentech actually did talk about getting into animal vaccines. Was Dennis Clyde there that day? Did you meet Dennis Clyde?
No, but I bet he was one of the first 16 people.
He was. He went there with Goodell, David Goodell. Did you meet Goodell?
We met Goodell, and we met a Dutch guy. Who was the Dutch
Heinecker.
Guy?
Herb Heinecker. Yeah. And
so they said, don't start a separate company. Just move out here. And you'll be the 17th and 18th employees. Come work here. And we said, we can't do that. That's a terrible idea. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I'll teach you a corollary to that idea later.
Okay.
Because that happened again. So that's, we started. We incorporated November 19th, 1979. I had already hired an administrative assistant. She was in residence in my dermatology office. I tried to do both things for a while, practice a little dermatology and run the company. Now it's getting close to, we've sort of got our hands on the money, but we're not getting along with Norman. And now we're not getting,
your friend, yeah.
Yeah. And we're not getting along with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of all yelling and screaming at each other.
What was going wrong?
Don't know. So Tony and I, you know, we saw Norman every week and everything, but Tony and I were together almost every day.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Norman is the problem here. Norman's doing stuff that we're not comfortable with, and we incubated that idea for a month or two and decided that Norman was the problem and we were going to part company. The day we closed with the investors in our lawyer's office, Norman was in one office,
mm-hmm.
kind of like the Wizard of Oz, behind a curtain, and the investors were out here. and it was sort of a three-ring circus. And basically that day we bought Norman up.
Mm-hmm. Was that a difficult thing for you? I mean, this is, was he a friend?
Well, Rick, the last I saw Norman.
Yeah. So you bought him out with the funds?
Just with stock.
Yeah.
A bolus of stuff.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to be a consultant to us or anything because we couldn't get along. The postdoc from the university that had been working on papillomavirus came over as the first employee. We rented about 2,000 square feet of space and built out a small laboratory.
Over at
the diner right behind the Sofitel.
Uh-huh.
And we were in business. I didn't know how to do it.
How to do what? The business or to do the vaccine?
The business. So I was tutored by the Norwich Growth Fund partner who was on our board. He came over on Wednesday afternoon. He taught our administrative assistant, this young woman, how to
keep
going.
What was her name?
Ellen Hendrickson. Most of the following 22 years, she was my administrative assistant in three different businesses. A little time off for good behavior. Came back. He taught her how to do projections and budgeting and all that kind of thing. When the company got going a bit, I hired a chief financial officer. His name was Robert Orr. He'd come from SRI. He's a recent Stanford Business School graduate. He said that he would take the job as our CFO if I would take an evening accounting course. So I went to...
So he could talk to the same language, you would have the same language?
So I took an evening accounting. I slept through 10 weeks of accounting and read a book. And that's how that all that went. We hadn't been in business very long when everything started to pop. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that we needed to raise more money and more or less broaden our vision. So we went from a wart vaccine to some other animal vaccines, and we went out to raise some more money. And there was no terminology at that time, but basically what we were looking for was a strategic partner that had deep pockets. And we spent a lot of time talking to Standard Oil in a tall white building in downtown Chicago and American Cyanamid. And because American Cyanamid had an agricultural business, that seemed to be a better bet. But by that time, there was a very good group of plant molecular biologists at the University of Minnesota. And they went to a conference at Rockefeller in New York, like in May of probably 1981. And when they came home, they asked if they could meet with us. There were four of them. And they said, we're being urged to start a company. Can you guys give us some guidance? And we said, you don't want to start a company. We got a company. Just take a hunk of this company. And when, you know, we go to that farm 60 miles south all the time, that's a corn farm. We see lots of corn. There must be some synergies here.
Mm-hmm.
So we got in the corn genetics business.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any concerns about getting defocused?
Sure. Oh, we did that. And in the long run, the corn genetics had more value than the animal vaccine.
Did the animal vaccines work?
One of them, the wart one, did. And that was a mistake, another mistake. We made a subunit vaccine by cloning one of the main co-proteins. I think it's called the L protein. And we could protect calves with that. We proved that. Kind of not the greatest proof in the world, but almost the greatest.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, we had built quite an organization. And we were starting to look at other things, like the economics of these projects. And it became clear that a bovine wart vaccine wasn't
big
worth
it. Enough. Yeah. The market wasn't big enough.
We had a guy working on it. This is probably around 1984. We dropped it. We dropped our patent application. But he presented at a conference. And at the end of the conference, he said, you know, the immunogenicity isn't great. Probably what we have to do is learn how to reassemble, pull capsids and vaccinate with that. Mm-hmm. And in the audience was the guy who did that.
Who did it?
NIH group, Doug Lowy, and can't remember the name of the other guy. Lowy's a dermatologist.
And then did that get commercialized?
Yes.
Who got the license?
I think that's the Merck version. I think Merck and Glaxo both have vaccines.
Yeah.
I'd have to think
about Merck
that.
Merck is the likely suspect, yeah.
Now, there was no basic patent on that concept. The patents, in fact, I believe, related to the manufacturing.
Recombinant manufacturing?
No, the reassembly. And then I don't know what Glaxo's entry was. I think Glaxo actually wound up with our clones. We had some East Coast collaborators. And we let them more or less walk off with the material.
You just dropped it and, yeah.
We just dropped it. So I'm going to tell you another story. You might ask why we weren't in the human biotechnology pharmaceutical realm of things. Well, fairly early on, we'd have to go back and do a little research. I saw the cover of the magazine section of the New York Times Sunday magazine. There was a picture of this man who went from UCSF over to Genentech with the stuff.
It was Ulrich or Seberg?
He's a Scandinavian.
They're German, Seberg and Ulrich. They took Seberg, the stuff out of the freezer, took the...
Seberg's picture was on the cover of the magazine section.
Right.
I read that article, and I saw that there was a physician involved in all of that by the name of John Baxter.
Yeah, he was UCSF, yeah.
I called John. And I said, what do you... He said, oh, you're in Minneapolis. He said, John was from Kentucky. And he said, when I was a kid, my daddy drove me up and we would fish in northern Minnesota. I love Minnesota. You know this southern accent. Can I come and visit you guys? So he came out, probably 82, and he said, I said, why don't you join us? We just created a corn division. We'll create a human pharmaceutical division. Oh, great. Let's write that up. I got some great ideas. I think we could clone erythropoietin, and that would be an interesting drug. Okay, John, why don't you join us? So we wrote this business plan. We made him an offer. And simultaneously, he was approached by E.F. Hutton. They wrote him a check for $10 million. I called one day, called his home. I called his lab. It's not the lab. He's home. Called his home. It's his wife. Said he hasn't been out of bed in 48 hours. He was kind of a nervous guy. But John was a real idea guy. John was brilliant. Couldn't get out of bed. Couldn't talk. He resurfaced the following week, and he said, called me, and he said, I can't do it. I've got to do my own thing. I've got to take E.F. Hutton money, and he started CalBio. Here's all these guys. Bill Rutter, Herb Boyer, they've got their own company. You know, I can't not have my own company. It was an ego. You know, it wasn't a bad decision. CalBio made a bunch of bad decisions, but they didn't relate to taking the first 10 million. So there's another guy situation. Well, I can't go with you. I got to do my own thing. Mm-hmm.
I had no idea there were all these tie-ins. Syntax and Intact, UCSF.
Sure. Yeah. Now, I don't think that was true for everybody, you know. But Rathman, it was true. I think in the very beginning, that Rutter was on the scientific advisory board. He was like a co-founder of Amgen.
I think they wanted him to have Amgen North. But at some point, he wanted to do, and he told Rathman, no, I want to do my own thing. I think that's how that
happened. Right. So there was a lot of interconnection. We took our company public in
1982.
83.
It was 83?
I think it was 83.
Yeah.
It might have been 82.
I think it was 82. 82, it wasn't the 83 was actually a good year for IPOs, wasn't it?
82 we took it public.
Yeah.
And we were having trouble doing an IPO, and we did a kind of a busted IPO. We raised like $1 million. Piper Jaffray here in town raised all the money. Uh-huh. PLJ and Montgomery Securities were co-managers, raised not a penny.
Uh-huh.
And
what went wrong with it? They just said, oh, we can't do it, or the market's not there? Or?
The market was just weak.
Yeah.
But we were left without much cash, so we had to scramble. And two things happened. Somehow or other, and I don't recall how, I was introduced to Martin Marietta, the chief financial officer of Martin Marietta. He was having simultaneous discussions with Ed Penhoek and with Peter Meldrum in Salt Lake City at Native Plants, which became NPR. They said, we'd like to form a consortium between the three of you and with us looking over your shoulder. And we'll get you all in a room together twice a year or something like that. and as a matter of good faith, here's a check for $10 million.
Uh-huh.
So we did that.
You did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I never got friendly with Peter. But I did get friendly with Penhold and Rutter. I had some other connections to Rutter. We had a,
And the idea was to work on human vaccines because that...
No, because Native Plants was doing plant stuff. We were doing plant and animal, and the other people were doing human.
Yeah, okay. So it's just...
So we really, for 2 or 3 years, we really hung out together. That deal was probably closed before the end of 82.
Uh-huh.
But meanwhile...
Is there any documentation for that? Because that's a real interesting story.
No.
I've never heard it before.
Well, but do you talk to Ed Penhold?
Well, not about that. I mean, that's...
Why don't you ask him about
that? Yeah, we will.
Do you talk to Peter Meldrum?
I
you will?
Yes, yeah.
Ask him.
Yeah.
But so, we met in San Francisco, we met in Salt Lake once, we met in Minneapolis, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just interesting, and it's one of these stories that hasn't
been never told. Did anything.
Yeah.
Never did it. Now,
were there good ideas? What came out of the discussion?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now that deal busted, that IPO was weak. And I'm walking through the airport one day, and I run into my friend Mort Greenberg, who's a stockbroker in Minneapolis. We grew up together in Duluth. And we start talking. I said, you're a stockbroker for Kidder Peabody. I need a better investment banker. He said, God, you should meet my guy in Chicago, Ted Berghorst. Has he crossed your radar screen?
No.
He should. By the way, my banker at DLJ was Tony James, Hamilton James III, who's the number two guy at Blackstone. Schwartzman's, he and Schwartzman, are the founders of this humongous hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
He's very, Tony. Very, very successful. But we're not on speaking terms.
Oh.
He said, let me make a couple calls. So Mort made a couple calls, and I get a call from Berghorst, and we meet, and he brings out an analyst from New York whose name, from Kidder, whose name is Doug Rogers. Has he crossed your screen?
No.
Sure.
Yeah?
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
So that's looking kind of good. We're going to raise some money for us. And the other thing is we were going to do... Are you running out of...
No, I'm just checking the battery. No, I'm just checking the battery. I want to make sure the battery is still...
So we're going to... We're going to hire Kidder, think about hiring Kidder, and I don't know the timing about Martin Marietta, Kidder, and then there's a third thing. We decided you could do something called an R&D limited partnership. And we did that with, what's the name of the firm in New York? Might have been A.J. Becker. But a large New York brokerage firm, and I think Piper was part of that deal. We raised $10 million that way, and...
What was it? And that has to be for a specific project.
We're throwing the vaccine stuff, and the
animal
vaccine, into the R&D Limited Partnership. Big deal. So $10 million of that. Now, that winter, there's a lot of conversation about our herpes virus work. It's starting to look pretty good.
Conversation in
with the
financial
stockbrokers. Stockbrokers are thinking about genital herpes.
Uh-huh.
We're doing herpes in pigs or something,
yeah,
and they're thinking about their genitalia.
Uh-huh.
And our stock goes from 0 to 16 or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do a secondary with Kidder as the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've maybe raised another 20. Now we give up $20 million in the bank. And that was good. We always had money after that.
Mm-hmm.
There were times when the stock got low. In 86, we did
I'll have some coffee.
I have two or three cup French press cups, or I think an Americano with a single cup.
Yeah, an Americano.
Cream or sugar?
Just cream.
Cream. Did I bring you anything else?
No. I'm actually good. We did another offering, a secondary with Kidder as well, and raised like another $20 million. Burghorst and I raised a lot of money together. By the time the R&D Lending Partnership and the Mary Etta thing, we had a fairly close relationship.
So he's instrumental in building the...
Okay, let's go back to the 86 thing.
Okay. The R&D Limited Partnership?
Now we're going to do
a secondary offering.
Yeah. Okay. We think we need another banker. And by that time, Doug Rogers has moved to Lehman Brothers. And I'm being courted by Fred Frank. So we actually did, he was the lead banker on that offering. And by that time, I had jettisoned Piper, and my banker, Piper, never talked to me again. And I jettisoned DLJ, and Tony James didn't want to talk to me again.
Uh-huh. But you thought it would be better to go to Lehman Brothers.
I thought it'd be better to have the money. I thought banking relationships were not too relational, that they were fee-for-service businesses and,
uh-huh.
and so forth.
Yeah, not really.
No, they probably, it wouldn't have hurt particularly to have kept PLJ around.
Yeah.
Piper and this regional market didn't have much value to us.
Uh-huh.
It was okay when you're raising $1 million, but if you wanted to raise $20 million or more,
right.
it wasn't material. Montgomery Securities never raised any. They didn't stick around very long.
Right, so... no reason to have any loyalty there.
No, but they had an analyst. I can't think of her name. She lives in San Francisco.
Denise?
She went to work for George Rathman eventually.
I don't know. At Amgen? When she went after? At
Icos.
Icos, yeah.
She was special. She's... great. I'm sure she still lives in the Bay Area. No, there's no documentation much for any of this stuff. This is the oral history. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, they're great stories. And
yeah. So we complete that offering probably around June of 1986. That's kind of tough sledding. And somehow or other, my boardroom gets messy. And by November of 86, I'm out.
Yeah.
Of molecular genetics. They're going to become a human pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the Norwest guy, by that time, has his own venture fund.
Uh-huh.
And the angel investor and I started another plant molecular biology company, not animal vaccine, called BioSeeds.
Uh-huh.
And then later in 1990, we sold that to Calgene. By that time, Salkvist and I are pretty friendly.
Uh-huh.
Have you taken Rogers?
Yeah, I like Roger.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, he's a trustee at the University of San Francisco, and we're going to do some event with him.
We had a it came to mind the other day. I saw on like Turner Classic Movies or something. I saw that they were going to show a movie called Run Silent, Run Deep.
Yeah.
And you know, Roger had been like captain of a submarine.
Right. Yeah.
So when we were putting our deal together, my side called it Run Silent, Run Deep. That was our secret code name. And our secret code name for Roger was Captain Nemo.
Had you been keeping track of Calgene when they got, because they got started just a little bit after you did?
Yes, I did. I knew the original CEO, and then when Roger took over, I remember my wife and I drove up to Davis and had dinner with him and his wife, and we were, you know, friendly competitor in the plant genetics area, and they really weren't looking to put genes into maize, in which is what our BioSeeds was set out to do.
Yeah.
And by the time we were doing that, we did a different business model. We bought a seed company, controlling interest in a seed company in early 1988.
Mm-hmm. But before we get into BioSeeds and this part of it, let me just ask a couple of questions going backwards.
Sure.
Very early on, you are working with the plant scientists here, right? So you're keeping an eye on Calgene, and there was Advanced Genetic Sciences, I think.
And PGS.
And PGS in Europe.
Walter Deloge.
Yeah.
In Ghent, Belgium. I'd been over there, and he and I had gone out to dinner together and got acquainted. And I still get a Christmas. He's in Malibu. I still get a Christmas card from him.
Maybe you can help me get in touch with him.
Yes, I can. He's a co-founder of Ceres. And one of my main advisors on the plant side was a scientist by the name Richard Clable, who's the chief scientific officer of Ceres in Thousand Oaks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was lured there by Walter.
Okay, yeah.
From a plant molecular biology institute in England,
mm-hmm.
called John Innes Institute.
Uh-huh.
And
there's also, I would like to get contact information for these folks so we can tie it all together.
Yeah, you can.
And there's also AgriGenetics, do you remember that?
Yes, David Padua and I became very good friends.
Did you? I went to Santa Fe, he's in Santa Fe.
Yeah, talked to him?
Yeah.
How is he?
He looks great. He's 80, I think.
I wonder how old he was.
He's 80.
It turned out that his oldest daughter, maybe it's his only child, and my oldest son went to college, or classmates at Wesleyan.
Oh.
And David was single then, probably still is. We would.
And he's married now.
Are you aware of this weird lawsuit?
What is the... Well, I know there's some weird, there's a lot of weirdness around David, I think, but what
okay, well, I don't really care to record that.
Oh, what? I can turn it off.